Before you can learn from the past, you have to remember it. For instance, the president was in Camden, New Jersey this week to unveil a plan to improve police-community relations in part by limiting the use of military hardware.
You know, we've seen how militarized gear can sometimes give people a feeling like there's an occupying force as opposed to a force that's part of the community that's protecting them and serving them.
Now, here's the part about remembering and learning. Just across the river from Camden is Philadelphia, which offered a powerful object lesson 30 years ago this month that hardly anyone remembers.
It sounds like automatic fire, Steve. There's quite a bit of it.
A radical group called MOVE, with a history of antagonizing neighbors and clashing with police, defied arrest warrants, and the police went in.
There's more gunfire right now. We're going to crouch down.
Police are unloading Winchester cartridge shells from the back of a highway patrol car.
MOVE had fortified a row house, and when a firefight didn't displace them, police dropped an incendiary device on the bunker constructed on the roof.
State police helicopter drops it. There is the explosion. As you can see, a very dramatic explosion that really rips into the MOVE compound.
Some of these homes would start burning.
You're telling me that the homes on the other side of Osage Avenue may be on fire?
That's correct. There's white smoke coming.
11 people died in that bombing, five of whom were children. The fire that spread destroyed 61 homes, scarring the block to this day. NPR correspondent Gene Demby is a native Philadelphian, and he reported on the 30th anniversary of the bombing. But the response to his reporting shocked him, because many people said they'd never even heard of it.
Yeah, I assumed that a lot of people would just jump in and be like, oh yeah, I remember when this happened. But we got the opposite response, like, wait, this happened?
So the people who said this happened, were they all from out of town or what?
I mean, it was hard to tell. Some people were from Philly, and some people seemed to be from elsewhere. But there was no obvious generational skew. I mean, it just seemed to be like this broad base. When did this happen? How did I not hear about this?
It wasn't just white people who were telling you this.
No, I mean, there were quite a few people of color who said that they hadn't heard of it either, which surprised me. But then as the days went on, I guess I stopped being surprised at how many people hadn't heard of it. I'm a Philadelphia native. I would have been 4 when this happened. And it wasn't something that was really discussed in Philadelphia, in part because as extreme as it was, there weren't a lot of ramifications for the city officials who were involved in it. And, you know, nothing changed all that much. No one went to jail. No one suffered any sort of long-term consequences. It was a cataclysm almost without consequence.
Do you know how it was covered at the time?
It was national news as it was happening. I mean, the Times covered it, but it didn't seem to have a very long tail.
How was MOVE characterized?
The Times called them a black radical group. Other people called them a black nationalist group. Ramona Africa, who's the only surviving member of MOVE, told me that she did not agree with the black nationalist label. One, they weren't nationalists, but two, they were actually founded by John Africa, who was black, but a Penn student who was white.
Was a co-founder?
Yeah, he helped germinate the early muddy tenets of MOVE. But she did say that they were revolutionaries.
I'm wondering what your prevailing theory is for why this didn't stick in the public mind. The long tail consequences, obviously, is one point. But I know that you reckon it was the nature of the group, of MOVE, that created a notable lack of alliances to keep this story alive. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, in the neighborhood that MOVE settled into in the early 80s, it was a pretty middle-class black neighborhood. MOVE actively antagonized the people in that block. I mean, they put megaphones on their compound, which was really just a fortified row house. And they just really, really got under the skin of their neighbors. They just cursed at the residents as they walked by. One Daily News reporter who was covering MOVE at the time said that MOVE very vocally broke up a very hard-won gang truce. There was a meeting between two rival gangs in West Philadelphia, and MOVE sort of came in and started yelling.
What did they want?
Oh, it's really hard to figure out what their specific political aims were. But this is what MOVE wanted on this block. In 1978, in another neighborhood in West Philadelphia, they had this really ugly standoff with the police, and a police officer named Jim Ramp died in that standoff. Several MOVE members, 9 of them, in fact, were convicted in that shooting. So MOVE relocated to 62nd and Osage, which is where this climactic conflagration happened. And what they wanted is not very linear. I mean, they wanted to lean on the residents of 62nd and Osage. They wanted to make life so unbearable that the residents of 62nd and Osage would then presumably lean on the city officials, who would then presumably lean on state officials to have the move non-released from state prison. It's a very long view kind of strategy. And so there was this big sense, even among Black community groups and Black radical groups, that move was a problem and a nuisance.
For instance, Bobby Seale, a prominent Black Panther, was not a fan of MOVE.
Yeah, Lynn Washington, who was the Daily News reporter that I spoke to, told me about a conversation he'd had with Bobby Seale. And Bobby Seale told him, how can you be a Black revolutionary group if you're plotting revolution against Black people?
Now, part of the reason why MOVE doesn't stick in the mind the way that, say, Ruby Ridge or Waco does is because this wasn't a standoff between the feds and radical groups. This was a standoff between local police and radical groups.
Yeah, that's right. Ruby Ridge and Waco and the Montana Freedmen standoffs, those could be folded into a larger conversation about gun rights and about federal overreach. We forget that in big cities, the police make up their own political class. They are a constituency unto themselves. And so it makes it harder for local officials to sort of drill down or to wag their fingers too pointedly at the police, especially then when there were a lot of concerns about urban violence, because the police tended to enjoy widespread respect, at least outside of, you know, communities of color. And, you know, as we see now, when there are big controversies over aggressive policing in Black communities, there often aren't repercussions, in part because of the politics of it.
Do you think it's even possible, Gene, to take a story that didn't fit into an established narrative when it happened and transport it 30 years into the future in the sense and fit it into the current narrative? You know what I mean?
You know, that's honestly kind of what we were trying to do, I think. We were trying to sort of tease out all the resonances you can see in the MOVE story to this story, this meta story of policing and Black folks that we've been covering over the last year, like what happened in Baltimore last month or what happened to Michael Brown in Ferguson. And it's not neat because the MOVE story sort of resists comprehension, right? I mean, it's the same story we see, but the volume is turned all the way up.
Yeah, the burning of an entire neighborhood and the death of 11 juxtaposed against the death of a single man. Not that one is worthless, but they would tend to generate different coverage.
Absolutely. If this happened today, there would be people with cell phones out watching these houses burn. There would be people nearby watching the police shoot up these homes on 62nd Osage. You would see a critical mass of outcry as it was happening. It is so confusing because this story is frankly insane, right? I mean, the more you learn about the details, the less sense it makes. Yeah, it would obviously set off some understandable outrage in 2013 or 2014 or 2015, but it is still sort of incomprehensible that it did not set off outrage in 1985, even if the media apparatus looked entirely different, right? I mean, it is the kind of thing that should have changed something, right? You would hope anyway, but nothing changed at all.
Gene, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Brooke.
Gene Demby is a correspondent for NPR's Code Switch.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.